Writer Christy Hodgen is adept at both short and long fiction, but this author of a short story book and two novels is quick to claim a preference.
I don't think I know a single writer who prefers writing novels to stories. Everyone loves to write stories. Everyone I know loves to read stories. It's sort of a mystery to me why they don't sell very well.
Christy Hodgen discusses combining forms to create her third book, a novel called Elegies for the Brokenhearted, today on New Letters on the Air, a production of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Since her first book, A Jeweler's Eye for Flaw, winner of the 2001 Associated Writing Program's Award for Short Fiction, Christy Hodgen has continued to explore flaws within characters and families in her following two novels, Hello, I Must Be Going, a 2006 Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers pick, and her 2010 novel, Elegies for the Brokenhearted. As the daughter of award-winning poet John Hodgen, she had a relatively happy childhood in Massachusetts, though she kept a watchful eye on those around her. We talked about that and how it forms her fiction at the Kansas City Plaza Public Library in late 2010. Here's Christy Hodgen reading to the audience from her novel, Elegies for the Brokenhearted.
We were a family of bad citizens, drunk drivers and tax evaders, people who parked in handicapped spaces and failed to return shopping carts to their collection stands. In traffic jams, we sped up the breakdown lane, then weaseled our way out of tickets by crying. For special occasions, we bought new clothes and wore them with the tags tucked in, then returned them to Filene's basement. We wrote bad checks and faked our ages for discount admission to movies. We ate from other people's plates. And so it was, silent night, holy night, out you went stumbling through the snow. Wasn't this blood? You were more blood to us than our own fathers. All six of us cousins had fathers who had run off. These two words, said so often together, they became one. Run off, run off, run off. All six of us, Ginny and little Ellen belonging to Lily, Carrie and little Lily belonging to Ellen, Melinda and me belonging to Margaret, had fathers and stepfathers and second stepfathers, the beautiful Beaudry girls having, it was widely known, a penchant for marriage, an even greater penchant for divorce. The beautiful Beaudry girls being, it was said, difficult to live without, but impossible in the end to live with. My mother was the favorite and worst of them, with five husbands. Melinda and I were born of her two-year marriage to Michael Murphy, high school sweetheart and union plumber, Sagittarius, blackout alcoholic. Next, she married another Michael, the devoted and long-suffering Michael Collins, high school history teacher and model ship enthusiast, Libra. Her third marriage, to a large appliance salesman named Bud Francis, Cancer, lasted 8 months and was sometimes forgotten about altogether. Her fourth marriage, to the mechanic Walter Adams, Libra, 20 years her senior and black. How fiercely this word was whispered amongst our family, black, black, black. Produced one child, Felice Shirley Adams, who lived, blue and squirming, for less than a day. Finally, she married the Reverend Les Witherspoon, a preacher she'd seen on cable television, raging about the end of the world, a Scorpio if she'd ever seen one. Later in life, I would try to explain these things to boyfriends, the who's who of the Beaudry Murphys, all of these exes and steps and halves, those firsts and seconds and thirds, those relations once and twice removed, but no one could keep up. How many mics are we talking about here? Said one. Four? Five? It's like Faulkner threw up.
That's a little bit from the beginning of Elegies for the Brokenhearted, a novel by Christy Hodgen, who's here with me on New Letters on the Air today at the Kansas City Public Library on the Plaza. This is actually her third book. She has a collection of short stories, A Jeweler's Eye for Flaw, and then also her first novel was Hello, I Must Be Going. And it seems to me, Christy, that you are intrigued with dysfunctional families, or that's what we seem to be exploring in much of your work. And yet, there's so much humor involved in this elegiac look at these people. How do you balance that?
Well, I don't think there's any other kind of family, you know, but a dysfunctional family. and perhaps I've pushed it a little bit, but really it's, I think, true to life. I, as far as the humor goes, find it necessary. The writers I admire, like Laurie Moore, will make you laugh, even as she's sort of twisting your guts. And if you're going to tolerate a long book, especially a novel that has quite a bit of gruesome material in it, you've got to sort of bring that humor as well. So I don't know that I consciously do it, but I think there's just a sense, if you've been really hammering at something for a while, that you need to finish on that light note, like the last line of the paragraph I just read, just to sort of take a breath.
I think it makes it all more bearable. You deal with these dysfunctional homes, not only in this, but in Hello, I Must Be Going. And yet, you come from a home, your parents are still married. You had a pretty normal life, except that you're a daughter of a poet, and how normal can that be? But where you came from is in some ways very different.
Although Worcester, Massachusetts, it's sort of a declining city, and one needn't look very far outside of one's stable home to see all kinds of things. And I think anyone who was half conscious and had one eye would have noticed that life wasn't going very smoothly for everybody. So I think if you're just, as I was, sort of quiet and unpopular, you develop habits of quietly sitting and watching, and there was quite a bit to see. And there is everywhere. You know, it's not just where I grew up.
Yeah. What was that like growing up with a poet?
He was my English teacher my senior year, which, you know, did not work out. it was just, you know, I'm a procrastinator, and so I wouldn't write my papers until the night before.
And he would know it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it was fine, but just a little bit awkward.
Did you read his work? Did you try to write poetry yourself?
No and no. actually, I'm repeating all of the same, you know, as we all do. I'm the same with my daughter now that he was with us. He was like a covert poet, didn't really show us anything. I sort of knew that he wrote poetry. He would get these rejections sometimes, and he'd be very upset by them. I'd read maybe two or three of his poems. And then when I was in college, I'd already moved away, and his first book got published. So he had a hard time as I was growing up. And then all of a sudden, maybe it has to do with the kids leaving the house, I don't know. But he started publishing left and right. And so then I got to read his work. And to this day, he doesn't show anybody anything until a book comes out. And I'm the same. Just like anyone else, you know, you have to order it off Amazon and wait for it, because we both had books come out this summer, and I ordered his and he ordered mine, and we hadn't read one another's work at all. And I think it's just this sort of dysfunctional privacy or embarrassment, you know? I describe my father and I as being the same, which is embarrassed to be alive, you know? We just want to show our work, and yet we do this thing where we put it out in the world. So it's obviously some sort of weird combination of being shy and also a total exhibitionist.
Yeah.
I never show anything to anybody before it comes out. So I guess I must have gotten that from him.
Wow. Interesting. Now, is it true that both of you were winners of the Associated Writing Programs prize?
I won it first. I'd like to point that out. Yeah, I won it in short fiction, and then I think 3 years later he won it in poetry.
Yeah. The different sections or different chapters of Elegies for the Brokenhearted could really stand by themselves. Did you see it as being a novel of stories?
That was my evil plan, in fact, yes. I wrote the first one as a story and realized halfway through it that I could just keep doing that. And I think the first three stand alone pretty well, and then the last two do not. There comes a point when you have to sort of sacrifice the ability of a piece to stand alone to make the novel come to some kind of conclusion, but it definitely for the first three, that's what I was thinking. Because I prefer to write stories. I think novels are massive undertakings, and I just have an easier time working with something that I can kind of see the end of.
your first novel was Hello, I Must Be Going. Do you think you got pushed? I mean, after your first collection of stories to write your first novel?
Oh, I absolutely did. The first novel was at one point 6 separate stories, and they had different narrators, and they bought the book, I think it was November 12th or something, and I had one day of pure happiness, and the next day, you know, that's when I finally got to talk to the editor, and they said, let's start making this a novel instead of these 6 stories. And
had to take a ton of work on your part.
It was more than I thought.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, well, I'll just rewrite everything in one voice, and it won't take that long. But then as soon as you change one thing, you know, everything else changes. And it took quite a while. And I had a lot of inner turmoil about my artistic integrity and everything. You know, why am I doing this? But I do think that process, as difficult as it was, taught me how to work long. For instance, you have to sort of hold some things back. Whereas in a story, you've got 30 pages and you got to make everything happen and finish up. And I learned, I think, in the process of sort of translating those stories into a novel, how to keep a few things going at once and delay certain things. And so it was very educational, although horrifying.
I think I'm going to have you read another passage. This one is from the James Butler section of the book, Elegies for the Brokenhearted, because he's one of the people who's not a member of the family, but he has his own family stories that run really well with Mary's. And this particular passage shows where Mary has a realization because of James Butler.
Just to set it up, this is a novel narrated by Mary Murphy, whose mother marries 5 times, etc. She has a sister, an older sister, Melinda, who is a runaway drug addict and who disappears. And then after she graduates, she goes off in search of her sister. And she lands in a resort town in Maine looking for her sister, who's been waitressing there. She ends up befriending James Butler, who is a middle-aged, failed child piano prodigy who went to Juilliard but never could finish. And he's been working at a piano bar at this resort town for many years. And they meet and spend the summer together. And I think in this passage, Mary starts taking drugs, and she's not quite in her right mind.
Are they at the Strauss house at this point?
Yes, they're staying at a summer tavern, the Bavarian, run by a German woman named Mrs. Strauss, who's tragically lost in the past. So it's the 3 of them sitting around drinking this homemade liqueur. Suddenly, I had theories swirling around my head. Could it be, I said, that this was home, this right here, for all of us? For wasn't home, I said, less of a place than a means of connecting with people? The problem was that we just didn't see it. The problem was that the world was made out of fabric, and it surrounded us so completely that we couldn't see beyond it. It was a prison, but it was thin, I was sure of this. And behind what we could see was more, infinitely more, I said, finer things, other realms, in which our spirits were free, without bodies, in which we were floating balls of light or gas, and what we were supposed to do was offer brightness to each other, commingle and make new colors, pass through one another gently, instead of what we were doing now, which was passing one another by and hiding in separate corners. And you had to wonder, I held my finger in the air here, you had to wonder if the horrible, drifting life we were all living now was all the result of the thinnest fabric. It was only the surface, and it didn't matter, and we could break through it quite easily if we wanted, if we only tried, to what was beyond. Togetherness. This mattered. We were all going around making the mistake of thinking that we were alone, and we just needed to stop and pay attention. We could all break through if we tried. Our hearts were beating in unison. All of our sorrows and fears were the same. If we stopped and realized it, if we all just stopped for a moment and really looked at it, saw through it, the world would be better. It would come together. It would heal. The barriers between us are as thin as the air we breathe, I said. We're all living at the same time and right next to each other, but there are different worlds and they don't intersect. They're parallel and discrete, but they needn't be. What matters, I said, is people. What matters is home, that we look at each other, really look at each other, and say to each other, you are what matters to me. You are home. You stared at me for a second, then burst out laughing. As always, you made a show of it, holding your stomach, pitching yourself forward. You sounded like someone instructing foreigners to laugh. Ha, ha, ha. Oh, ho, ho. He, he, he. Then one of the clocks struck the hour, and another, until all of the cuckoos were bursting forth from their doors, then retreating, then bursting forth again. When the birds finished calling, each clock played a little song, and they swirled together in an awful clashing of chimes. As the clock sounded, I saw everything I'd just been talking about, which I'd been completely convinced of, which was so real to me that I could see it glimmering in front of me, disappear. I could actually see it evaporating from the air. I was crushed. When it was time to leave for work, I was so drunk that it was an effort for me to see or to walk. I spent great concentration putting one foot in front of the other. I was under the impression that I was moving very fluidly, with an uncommon grace, but you said, my God, look at you, pull yourself together. I'm okay, I said, and looked at you very solemnly. I'm just a little out of my elephant.
Another section of Elegies for the Brokenhearted by Christy Hodgen, who's here with New Letters on the Air at the Kansas City Public Library on the Plaza. At this point, Mary, who is basically homeless, is looking so hard to find what home means for her. Is this a theme of yours?
Oh, certainly. It's kind of strange being a writer because you often end up in these casual conversations, like in the pickup line in your kid's school parking lot, and people say, what do you write about? And, you know, it's difficult. And I finally came up with just families. That seems to just work for everybody. But if I were being more direct, it would be, you know, like despair, you know, or crushing existential pain. You know, I mean, I think loneliness, finding a home, finding connection, that's what every writer almost tries to tackle.
So how did this begin to take shape as a novel?
Unlike other pieces of mine, I wrote it straight through.
Wow. That happens so rarely, I think.
It does. I think the structure of this was such that I had to write it in order because each piece would sort of span 20 years, and then you'd go on to the next piece and start back where you started the first piece, and it had this almost kind of repetitive structure, really, where almost every piece started when Mary, the main character, was a child, and talked about the whole time that she knew this person who's passed away. And so I couldn't mess around too much as I was working on it. I had to kind of get the first thing in place and then move on.
One thing that occurred to me in reading this book is that Mary has the sensibility of a writer and a watcher, that outsider who's observing the world. The only difference is she's not writing about it.
I think that's my standard narrator, yeah, which can become difficult because at some point you want your character to do something other than sit back and watch other people. So about 3/4 of the way through almost every project I work on, I hit this crisis where I just want to throw the whole thing away because I just can't think of anything to make my character do. I'd say that's my nemesis, having that quiet, watchful narrator, and then also having to bring some sort of momentum to it towards the end where something happens. So that's my difficulty, I think.
Tell us a little bit about your writing habits. Are you one of these early morning people, or are you a late at night person?
I'm a whatever works person, and early morning was the case with this book. 5 o'clock. I've got a daughter that gets up at 7 and a job and everything, and so I had to steal those 2 hours before anything started happening in the day. Now I'm not doing that as much because I'm writing stories and they don't require that kind of daily sustained agony. I just try to grab some time whenever I can. I wish I were one of those disciplined people who keeps a separate office and gets dressed and goes there every day from 9 to 5. And maybe someday I will, but right now my life doesn't really allow for that.
Yeah. I'm talking today with Christy Hodgen for New Letters on the Air. Her newest book that's out now is Elegies for the Brokenhearted. Did you publish any part of it separately? Since the first three stories particularly can stand on their own, I wondered if you...
The first two I sent out.
Where?
Mike Beaudry went to the Southern Review, and then...
How appropriate.
Yeah. And then Elwood Lepore, the second chapter, was in American Short Fiction, which is a magazine I quite like. Yeah. They only publish short stories.
So Mike was first, or was Mary first? I mean, it was Mary's perspective all along?
There's always a narrator and a voice that comes to you. I suppose that would be first. What I tried to do with this book, I've sort of had a disaffected young female narrator for, you know, the last 12 years or however long I've been writing. And I got a bit tired of that. And so I was still using that voice here, but she was talking about other people. So it gave me the relief of sort of having a crushed adolescent talking about herself all the time, right? So she's the speaker, but she's talking about these people she knew. So I felt a little bit better able to balance that young angst, you know, with the adults or other people she's looking at around her.
Yeah. You know, you have this real interesting technique that you use in this book where the character is relating the story in first person, and then suddenly she addresses the character that is in that elegy as you.
There are times when Mary's talking about herself in the first person, but then times with the direct address to that other character. It swaps between first and second.
That flipping around I found very interesting. At first it was throwing me a little bit, but then as I got into it, it's, you know, like reading something without punctuation, you finally get the flow of it. So what made you do that?
You know, I don't know what compelled me. And I suspect that my editors at Norton were flustered because you're not supposed to write a novel in second person. It sort of throws people. And certainly calling it Elegies for the Brokenhearted was a bit of a downer. And it just seemed like I was doing everything I could to make it the worst book in the world, you know. You know, you're just not supposed to write a second-person novel. Bright Lights, Big City was second-person, but, you know, they're quite rare as novels. And I don't think anyone said I couldn't do it, but I don't think it was the easiest thing to work with or try to describe or sell. And other than being perhaps self-defeatist somewhere deep down inside, I don't know what why I did it. It's just sort of the way it presented itself.
Yeah. Well, it works. I've got one more passage I'd like for you to read for us from Elegies for the Brokenhearted. This comes from the same section of the book from James Butler, talking about him as a composer. And it, to me, said a lot about the art of putting things together, of creating something that will touch people.
This passage, I guess, is James Butler has died and he's left Mary his notebooks in which he was trying to compose a symphony, and she's flipping through them, just looking at what he was trying to do. Most valuable to me were the notes you'd made to yourself in the margins. Often you wrote the names of composers and passages from other works. You were fond of Satie, Debussy. You had a particular fascination with Beethoven's Seventh, but in other places you'd made notes about the feelings of the passages, the moods you hoped to create. What you hoped to create with your music, it seemed, was a sense of the solitary, the ruminative. You sought to create within the listener the sensations that come upon us in private, withdrawn moments. Kicking a rock down the street, you wrote. Waking to rain in the night, flying in dreams, a neighbor seen through the window, voices in another room, children at play in the distance. If your work made one thing clear to me, it was that your life was a battle. Essentially, you had withdrawn into your work, into solitude, and yet, what was your work but an effort to communicate, to be understood? Even the evocation of loneliness was something undertaken with the purpose of communicating it to someone who would hear it and perhaps understand it. What impressed me most was how similar our lives were, yours, mine, and everyone we knew, and yet how little we'd noticed the connections. We had all known joy and then lost it, had blindly sought after it again. We had taken up burdens and carried them for a time, then stumbled beneath them. We had made strides and then lapsed. We had taken strange paths that sometimes delivered us to safety and sometimes led us astray. We had despaired, tried again, despaired, tried again. Through it all, we had somehow felt ourselves alone, misunderstood. In the end, you believed you had failed. You seemed to have died in despair. All through that winter, my mind was occupied with the question of whether life was worth living. To have ambitions, to make plans, to hope, to work, to dream, to enter into friendships and love affairs, I wondered if there was any point. I went back and forth. I still had the bottle of pills you'd given me, and sometimes I thought of taking one. I imagined myself suddenly made loquacious, vibrant, giddy, going out to join the world, to seek my fortune. I imagined throwing my hat in the air, like Mary Tyler Moore. But then again, it seemed to me that all such efforts, at least the ones I'd witnessed, led to disaster. In my darker moments, I held that bottle of pills in my hand and stared at it. I thought of taking them all at once. One night, I went through the notebook you'd been working on the summer I lived at the Bavarian, and I came across the passage you had played over and over again, the one I had woken to in the middle of the night, the notes rising and falling, which had sounded to me like a leaf tossed in the wind. And suddenly the question I'd been turning around in my mind, whether two people could ever reach each other or whether we were all hopelessly alone, found a surprising answer. What convinced me that all was not lost, that there was still hope, that people, in fact, understood one another, if only in the smallest of ways and mostly unnoticed, was something you'd written just above those plaintive notes, a leaf tumbling to the ground.
That's a beautiful passage from Elegies for the Brokenhearted. I'm talking today with Christy Hodgen for New Letters on the Air at the Kansas City Public Library on the Plaza. It's a very lovely book. Where we come to by the end of it is not necessarily where we were expecting to go, and yet it's very satisfying where we end up.
Thank you.
So you said you're writing stories right now, so does that mean your next book is going to be a collection of stories?
My next book that I write will be a collection of stories. Whether or not it gets published is who knows.
Christy, thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Christy Hodgen teaches writing at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. In 2011, she received a Guggenheim Fellowship to work on that collection of short fiction she mentioned, her fourth book to be called Bedtime Stories for the Middle-Aged. If you'd like to listen again to today's show, go to newletters.org/radio, where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast. If you'd rather purchase a CD, call toll-free 888-548-2477. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine, published by UMKC with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with help from Annie Walsh, Luke Steelman, Dennis Conroe, and Stephanie Hughes. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.